is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking about a very interesting subject today, one that affects many families and one that Christians haven't given a lot of thought to, at least in recent years. When does a boy become a man? Does that sound like some kind of esoteric issue? Not at all. That's one of the issues that is now being addressed in families, being addressed in churches. A lot of good biblical-based Christian worldview-thinking Christians are giving some real thought to this. We're going to be talking about it. First, a review of the news. Of course, some of you have been aware of what's coming up on Sunday, April 24, 2005. It's Justice Sunday. The Family Research Council, Focus on the Family, and some others are gathering together. And it's going to be culminating in a big event here at Highview Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. The speakers are going to be James Dobson, myself, and Charles Colson, along with an appearance by Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. And it's going to be a major event because we're going to be looking at one of the most pressing issues facing America today, and that is the judiciary and what it would take for us as Christians to think through these issues, to make certain we know what to expect of judges, and to make certain we know what our responsibility is to encourage that those who are nominated by the president, who are qualified for office, get the vote they deserve, an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate. Now, as you can imagine, the secular left is absolutely up in arms about this, crying out that this is a violation of the separation of church and state and all the rest. Well, that's just nonsense. We are Christians meeting together. This is a simulcast involving as many as 1,000 churches. It's also going to be on SRN News, the Salem feed. It's also perhaps going to be on some other television networks, may even be covered by C-SPAN. But primarily, it's Christians talking to Christians. And that's exactly what we ought to do. I'm going to be talking about that controversy over the next several days, and we're going to have a very focused conversation about it very soon, looking at exactly what this event means and what the secular response to it ought to tell us about where we stand in post-Christian, post-modern America. It's a pretty frightening thing the more you think about it, but knowledge is power. So knowing about it, thinking about it, talking about it, we can move on to what we should do about it as well. There's some fascinating things in the news just over the past weekend and today. First of all, there is a news story that came in the Lexington Herald Leader here in Kentucky. A headline, "Kids Swear Almost Incessantly. Teachers Lament the Erosion of Language Skills and Blame Pop Culture." This is from the Washington Post originally by reporter Valerie Strauss. She goes into an English class in high school where at Guilford High School in Rockford, Illinois, teacher Dan Horwich says that he does not allow profanity or swearing in the classroom, but as soon as the kids get out of the class, as soon as the bell rings, they go back into their normal mode of using incessant swear words. Now, I think there's something to this story that ought to really catch our attention, because this is what I hear out in the mall. I'm absolutely amazed. This is what I hear just out in at sporting events. This is what I hear in so many public arenas where it seems like swearing, using obscene language, profanity, has become an absolute mode of speech and communication for a lot of people. Now, is it the influence of hip-hop culture? Is it just the devolution of our society in terms of a lowering of standards? Is it the influence of pop culture and music and all the rest? I don't know. It's an unbridled conscience when it comes to the tongue. From a Christian moral perspective, we need to understand it's not just the words in terms of the sounds they convey, but rather it's the words in terms of the crudeness that is irreducibly attached to these words. Someone's trying to make a point. Now, I remember what my grandfather told me a long time ago about swear words. He said, people who don't have a point to make and don't have confidence in what they have to say use swear words to cover up their own lack of confidence. And there's something really to that. And we know that the coarseness of our society, reflected in this language, has a ripple effect throughout the entirety of our culture. And the coarseness of our language is reflected in the coarseness of entertainment and the coarseness of art and the coarseness of the symbolism and the coarseness of the attitudes that is now so prevalent all over our society. We need to be watching this, and we need to watch our own tongues, and we need to be aware that our children are listening to us and they are talking. picking up the language that they're hearing from others. If you allow your kids to listen to the kind of music, the kind of rap, the kind of MTV broadcast that uses this kind of language, don't be surprised when they talk this way. Even if they don't have this as a first-order language, it's going to be embedded in their minds, and they're going to be thinking these words even when they're not saying them. More and more, they're saying them. Fascinating article in another newspaper over the weekend by Thomas A. Bowden about a moral right to suicide. Mr. Bowden is with the Ayn Rand Institute, and he is writing that Americans have a constitutional right to commit suicide. In the aftermath of the Terri Schiavo tragedy, he's coming back and saying that the Supreme Court needs to revisit its 1997 decision, Washington v. Glucksberg, in which the Supreme Court held that individuals have no constitutionally protected right to suicide. He thinks he's got a good chance to see this Supreme Court reverse that decision because, after all, he himself cites the 2003 Lawrence v. Texas decision, suggesting that the court has found an individual liberty to sodomy, so it just as easily can find an individual liberty to suicide. But I want you to listen to the worldview conflict that is embedded in his argument. Listen to these words. The conservatives' outrage at the Oregon law, that's the Oregon suicide law, stems from the belief that human life is a gift from the Lord who puts us here on earth to carry out his will. Thus, the very idea of suicide is anathema because one who plays God by causing his own death or assisting in the death of another insults his maker and invites eternal damnation, not to mention divine retribution against the decadent society that permits such sinful behavior. Now, let's hold on. He's trying to describe my position. I hope as I'm speaking to you today, he's describing our position. Is he right? Well, I'm going to tell you right up front, I think he is. I think he's nailed us. I think he does understand the issue. He understands that if human life is God's gift, then we are answerable to the giver of that gift for the taking of that gift, for the misuse of that gift, and the rejection of that gift. And he is absolutely right. He understands the logic of the Christian worldview understanding of life and death, and of course, therefore, of the immorality of suicide. But then he goes on to say, when religious conservatives use secular laws to enforce their faith in God, they threaten the central principle on which America was founded. The Declaration of Independence proclaimed, for the first time in the history of nations, that each person exists as an end in himself. This basic truth, which finds political expression in the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, means in practical terms that you need no one's permission to live, and that no one may forcibly obstruct your efforts to achieve your own personal happiness, end quote. Now, about that, I can only say hogwash. Nonsense. That is ridiculous. The Declaration of Independence does not suggest that every individual exists as an end in himself. That is a recipe for anarchy, not for government. The Declaration of Independence was about the independence of colonies, not the independence of individuals. It did cite that individuals as citizens have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But this government has never held that the right of the individual is the ultimate reality, with each person existing as an end in himself. If that were true, you could not have laws that say how fast you can drive. If that were true, you could not have a draft that says you can be forced to fight. If that were true, you could not have the entire system of civil government that holds this country together. This is a radical individualism, the likes of which most Americans have never seen. And in the Ayn Rand Institute, and by the way, you can go to see their philosophy at Ayn Rand, that's AynRand.org. By looking at that, you can understand where exactly they are. But by the way, the Randians are atheists, and their completely secular worldview holds that radical individualism is the only good, the supreme good, and that indeed this blatant suggestion that the highest purpose in life is self-fulfillment leads them to say that individual liberty cannot be constrained or fettered in any way, even by a law that says that suicide is illegal. And, of course, remember that someone who successfully commits suicide is not put under arrest. That law that says that suicide is illegal is basically a legal construct to prevent persons from assisting that suicide without involving themselves in a criminal act, or to suggest suicide, or to force suicide. That's a very important protection of human life, and one more reminder of what we're up against. Meanwhile, in Cremona, Italy, Italian scientists have reported cloning a horse. They say they've done so for the second time, a new foal created from the DNA of a thoroughbred Arabian gelding that was twice world endurance champion. I have to say, I find some irony in this, that this is a cloned gelding. So you thought geldings couldn't have offspring? Well, according to these Italian scientists, they can now by human cloning. They said this new approach opens the possibility of conserving the genetic inheritance of exceptional horses whose genetic heritage gets lost because they are castrated, etc., etc. Now, what is the value of this for us? It is a reminder that this clonal technology that began with very small organisms and then took a giant leap with Dolly, the sheep, is now, at least by the claim of these Italian scientists, reaching an animal the complexity of a horse. Now, you and I both know that one of the real goals of this technology is to clone human beings, and to clone them in terms of what is called reproductive cloning, that would allow persons to control their own reproductive destiny by cloning themselves. It is a page right out of science fiction that is about to become scientific fact. And I'll be watching it with you. When we come back, we're going to be asking the question, when does a boy become a man and why does it matter? I'd love for you to join the discussion. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Today I am a man. Those are the words from the Jewish bar mitzvah ceremony, and that's very much a part of the Jewish culture, and I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that, because I don't think they mean, literally, that at age 13 or whenever the boy is bar mitzvah, he just becomes a man. I don't think he's out on his own. By and large, he's not living on his own. He's not providing for his own. He's not legally responsible for all of his own affairs. And as a matter of fact, you can go through a ceremony. That still doesn't mean you can vote or sign up and enlist in the armed forces. I'm not making light of it, though. I think there's something to the ceremony that recognizes that there is a period of life in which a boy becomes a man. But I had an interesting email from a young man. And by the way, when I got it, I didn't know how young the young man was when he sent this email to me, asking the question, when does a boy become a man? I knew there had to be something behind that question. And sure enough, there was. It was a very earnest and an intelligent question from a teenager who was just considering some of the issues in terms of the biblical order between men and women and trying to figure out how he fit into that and how family and school and church and all should take this into account. It is a tough question for us, isn't it? Because in the background of this is the invention of adolescence over the last couple of hundred years, in which we have this period in which there's this almost a man, but not yet. And, of course, there are analogies on the female side when a girl becomes a woman. But today we're looking at the question, when does a boy become a man? And when I was asked this question, I decided I'm going to answer it. And so I set down 13 different rules or principles for determining when a boy becomes a man. I don't know if I'll add to these. I can't think I'll take any away, but this was a first shot at trying to define functionally and biblically and theologically when a boy becomes a man. Here's my argument. Number one, when he reaches the point of spiritual maturity sufficient to lead a wife and children. I think the spiritual maturity has to come first. Secondly, personal maturity sufficient to be a responsible husband and father. Economic maturity sufficient to hold an adult job and handle money. Physical maturity sufficient to work and to protect a family. Sexual maturity sufficient to marry and to fulfill God's purposes. Moral maturity sufficient to lead by example of righteousness. Ethical maturity sufficient to make responsible decisions. Worldview maturity sufficient to understand what is really important in life. Relational maturity sufficient to understand and respect others. Social maturity sufficient to make a contribution to society. Biblical maturity sufficient to lead at some level in the church. Verbal maturity sufficient to communicate and articulate as a man. And character maturity sufficient to demonstrate courage under fire. Now, as I look at that, I have to say, I'm not sure that we can put any age on that arbitrarily. As a matter of fact, I'm sure we can't. There's no particular date on the calendar where a boy reaches all of these hallmarks and then becomes a man. But somewhere in those late teen years, And I think that's where this must happen. A boy becomes a man. And then that's recognized in our college development in terms of this age between, say, 18 and 22, when most young men are in college. That's kind of an extended adolescence. But certainly by the time a young man graduates from college or reaches about that age, about age 22, he should fulfill all of these hallmarks and should be ready to take his place as a man. And if that is not the case, then something has gone wrong. We've been talking about this extension of boyhood into what should be the years of manhood. We've been looking at the delay of marriage and the fact that this is a generation that in many ways won't grow up. And I appreciated this question from a young writer who was asking this question honestly, and I really had to frame this in my own thinking in terms of what this would mean. And I'm not only looking at this as a theologian, I'm not only looking at this as someone involved in public policy, I'm looking at this as a father of a boy who just recently turned 13. And this is becoming something of an outline for my teaching and my leadership in his life as well. But I want to know from you out there, when do you think a boy becomes a man? And I want to tell you why it's really important, because it has to do with order in the church. It has to do with order in the home. It has to do with expectations of this young man. It has to do with how we prepare them to be ready to assume adult responsibility. Now, here's my theory. If a boy doesn't know what a man is, he can't know what he's supposed to be aiming for. And unfortunately, an awful lot of the men he observes aren't acting like men. And beyond that, there are more of them who can't articulate what it means to be a man. And I think if we can't articulate it, we can't teach them. Now, I'm not sure that my list is perfect. In fact, I'm sure it's not. And I know that there may be many of you out there who have something to add to this. And there are some folks giving fascinating attention to this. Doug Wilson has his book, Future Men. Robert Lewis of Little Rock has his book on raising a modern-day knight. I think there are a lot of good ideas out there, and I think a lot of Christian churches are trying to think this through, because we know there is a problem that boys are not growing up as they should into a healthy biblical manhood, and we better take the responsibility to help them, and that means to teach them, and that means to lead them. We need to live before them as men, and we need to tell them what would be required of them. But when does this happen? In other words, when should we see this happening? When does a boy become a man? How much of a factor is age? I've met some 15-year-olds who I thought were incredibly mature and showed signs of manhood, and I've met 30-year-olds who didn't. But certainly there has to be some kind of minimum age. But I'm telling you, we're in big trouble when we have this entire generation that seems so unwilling to grow up. I appreciated the letter from this young man because I can tell he's serious. And I can tell he wants to be a man, and he wants to make sure that he knows what he is supposed to be aiming for. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Perhaps you are a father, and this has been a concern for your son. Perhaps you're a son, and perhaps you are a young man, and this has been a concern for you. Perhaps you're in a church that has formalized this in some way, either a program of study and instruction, a mentoring program, or maybe even some kind of ceremonial transition. I'd love to hear what you are thinking about. 877-893-8255. I'm going to go to Rebecca calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN Radio. Rebecca, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, I go to a pretty large church, and I'm curious why it's a rare occasion that you see a man finally kind of reach manhood and maturity for especially Christianity until they're close to, 28, 30, something like that.
Well,
like they
Rebecca,
have to go through a lot of bad, decisions before they finally kind of get it.
Yeah, well, maybe we're kind of slow learners, but Rebecca, I'd love to hear from a female perspective here, a Christian woman in a church. What are you looking for? In other words, what defines a man for you?
Somebody who's consistently making godly decisions, where it's more than about impressing people. It's more, looking to God for answers. More of a heart issue than just being financially secure, or, I'm married. I've been married 10 years, but I'm an observer. I watch and I see, and that's just what I've noticed.
Yeah, well, Rebecca, I think you're noticing what a lot of people are noticing, and I think it's interesting that the first caller we have on a program about when a boy becomes a man is a woman calling to say, honestly, I'm not seeing a lot of this transition, and I think, guys, we better hear this. This is an indictment about the state of manhood in the church. And when I asked Rebecca to define it, this was not her word, but she came down to leadership, a godly leadership, a man who predictably makes the right decision, sets the right priorities in terms of God's word and the challenges of everyday life. I find it encouraging that that's what a Christian woman is looking for in a Christian man. That thrills me. What do you think about this? I'd love to hear from some parents, maybe some young men. Maybe some of you in local church ministry dealing with this issue. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We don't have anything quite like a bar mitzvah. Some churches are trying to come up with some kind of analogous ceremony here. I don't know if that's the right way to go or not. Tell me what you're thinking. 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
I think America valorizes boyhood in terms of entertainment and other culture, and it penalizes young men for growing up because it really does not put a priority on all the hallmarks of maturity. If you look at the heroes and the movies, they're in many ways just not mature human beings. You look at the entertainment culture and all the rest, and then you just think about the net result in the entire culture, and you see all these young men who basically just hang around with other young guys. They're not coupling. They're not moving towards marriage. They're not assuming responsibility. Sometimes they're going from job to job, playing video games late at night, doing all the kinds of things that you might associate with high schoolers or even young college students, but not with people who ought to be out making a productive contribution to society. I think this is one of the major symptoms on our national thermometer of where we have reached a fever pitch problem. I think we're now reaching the point that the norm is becoming this delay of manhood, and I think we're reaping the social consequences of that. Let's go to Eric, listening on WTBN, calling from St. Pete, Florida. Eric, go right ahead.
How you doing? Thank you for having me on.
I'm glad to have you, Eric. Go right ahead. When does a boy become a man?
Well, I think it's two parts to that. I think that we're going to naturally become a man, and I believe that's about 18. But what is a man is the other question, and I don't know when that comes. I think that generally the ones who do become men tend to become a man about 25. I do agree with the female caller. She said it's something about 25. I think that's when we get into the groove of things, especially those who love the Lord. But I think it's a two-part. The question is, what is a man? Because we're naturally going to become men physically in the sense of, at 18 and, 21, when we can vote and get our driver's license and things of that nature.
Now, Eric, you made a fascinating statement, Eric, when you said that kind of biological manhood comes, you said, around 18. Obviously, a boy generally that has been through puberty and has reached a more or less adult size and something like adult strength, large enough to take care of himself. He can feed and clothe himself, we should hope, and do all that. But you kind of dated emotional or personality manhood about 7 or 8 years later. Now, let me ask you, Eric, don't you think we ought to be getting those closer together? I mean, to me, that sounds like a problem you've just diagnosed.
Yeah, I think it is. But I think, and not to belittle or take away from the female, but from my own observation, oftentimes the father is not there. And even if he is physically still not there, but the women have it, when their menstrual cycle, their mother's there. When they start to develop, the mother's there to say, oh, baby, this is what's going on and this is what's happening. But when we go through our things, oftentimes there's no man there. And then when we do get advice, it's foolish advice from my own experience. You do this, what makes a man? Because I know for me, my college years were painful mentally because of my question was, what is a man? And every one of my answers, it came to me in the number of women you have and other things of that nature. And then I couldn't, and thank God that I got that, because if I had found a physical man, I think I would still be messed up. But it all led me to Jesus, into what is a man. And I found that real men love Jesus. So that's, I think, I don't know what goes on, but for us, I think it's just something from my experience. I teach high school, and it's something about men don't get it till about 25, from my experience.
Well, Eric, God bless you. Your call's 14 karat gold. It was just great to hear from you. And I appreciate your Christian testimony in the midst of that, as well as your personal testimony. And yeah, I think you've diagnosed a problem, this delay of manhood. And I think, by the way, that your observation that a lot of guys just don't get it till about 25, you're about right. And I think what we have to do is help them to get it earlier, because during all those years they're not getting it, they're getting in trouble. And they're getting other people in trouble, too. I'd love to know what you think about this. And I'm surprised I really haven't heard from some parents who would want to make a contribution to this, and or maybe from some young guy out there who says, hey, you know, I'd kind of like to talk to you about what it's like to be on this end. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Very quickly, let's go to Melissa, listening on WTB. And Melissa, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Amen to Brother Eric. I am a parent. I have a son who's 11 and a son who's 7. I have an unbelieving husband. And I have to teach my kids the full counsel of God at home because they're not going to get it in these watered-down churches that preach a very smooth gospel, good, you know, self-esteem gospel. No one's preaching against fornication. If they were, these kids wouldn't be waiting until they're 25 because to get married. They'd be ready at 20, believe me.
Melissa, God bless you. I wish you could come join my church because I'd love to have a mother with your conviction in it. And you're right. If the church isn't preaching it, why are we surprised? When we see young men not growing up into manhood. After all, if they don't know what it is and what it's supposed to look like, how in the world are they going to aim for it? That was a great word from Melissa. I'd love to hear from you. 877-893-8255 from Louisville, Kentucky. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Yeah, I'm going to tell you the truth. I can remember thinking about this when I was a boy. You know, what does it look like to be a man? Fortunately, I had a godly father, and he played the role of a man. He was a man, and I could see him. I could learn from him, and that was probably more important than I could ever estimate. But I never really had anyone say, here's a list. You know, here's what it looks like. And I think it's because in a day of less confusion, you probably didn't have to say so much. But in a time in this generation with so much confusion, I think you got to say more. Somehow there's this inverse formula. The more confusion, the more you got to talk. The more you got to clarify. The clearer you have to be about what really represents manhood. Remember, I said spiritual maturity, personal maturity, economic maturity, physical maturity, sexual maturity, moral maturity, ethical maturity, worldview maturity, relational, social, biblical, verbal maturity, and character. It seems to me that character is kind of a summary of all that, but of course there's more as well. I'd love to know what you think. I think this is one of those issues that we may revisit from time to time. This list may get a little longer. I can't imagine it would get any shorter. I'm going to go to Amy calling, listening on WFGQ in Iowa. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I think a lot of it. A man or a boy becoming a man depends on accountability, too. I know a gentleman who has 4 kids from 3 women, and none of which he takes care of on his own. He lives with his mom and his father, and he has no job and is using the welfare system. So,
5 alarm fire, Amy. 5 alarm fire. Just think of that list we were talking about. Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who is no man. I mean, he may be legally a man, he may be biologically a man, but if he's got 3 kids, he's not taking care of any of them, the 3 different women, good grief, what a meltdown here, and he's living with mom and dad, living with mommy and daddy. There you got it. Something's wrong with this picture.
Exactly. If he would have to be responsible and take, you know, control over and take responsibility over what he has done, then he would be a man.
I'm with you, Amy. Oh, you know, I wish I could say that that kind of tale that Amy just told is isolated and rare, but you know it's not. It's all too common. Let's go to Jeff calling from Clearwater, Florida. Go ahead, Jeff. All right, we lost Jeff. Rod in Cleveland, Ohio. Listen to WHK. Rod, your turn.
Hello. Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead, Rod.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. You know, my thought is that it really starts off early in life because so many of us, men and women, as fathers and mothers, have no clue what a real man looks like, so we don't know how to start targeting our child toward that. We wait till 14, 15 years old to try to start instilling these things, and it's not there. It's too late. Well, we needed to start a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
I think we need to as mothers and fathers, begin to go back and look at the example of Job and look at what our Bible teaches us and make sure that not only are we teaching it, but that we're demonstrating it so
yeah.
that they can see what it looks like as well as be told what to look for.
Rod, you're exactly right. And that's why a boy needs a dad. I mean, if there's any one just clear, quintessential explanation for that fact, it's that a boy needs a dad because that's where he's going to see this. And if he doesn't have a dad, God bless him, those who love him and are taking care of him better get a surrogate dad there, either a grandfather or an uncle or a trusted Christian man who can show this boy what manhood's supposed to look like. Because you can describe it all you want. You can talk about it and define it. You can line it out and read about it. But if you don't see it, it's almost impossible to understand. I think that's really important. Let's go to Sean, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Sean.
Hello, Dr. Mulder. Thank you for taking my call. In talking about this list, one thing that's just on my mind and heart, and being in the church and being a pastor of the church, is this whole idea of men realizing their biblical responsibility, fulfilling that role that Scripture has called them to. We've got fathers who are in the home, but they really aren't fathering according to that scriptural model and investing time, especially in their boys, to help them understand what a biblical man is.
Yeah, well, I think you are exactly right. And I think we're reaping the harvest of a generation that hasn't seen it, hasn't been taught it. And that's why just having a man in the home isn't enough if he's not showing what manhood's supposed to look like, don't you think?
Absolutely, I agree. You know, I have two young sons, and they're still very young. I'm not really to that point of being able to invest in them scripturally. They're 2 years and 2 months. But I'm very mindful of this huge responsibility that I have to model godliness before them. Not just to be a father in the secular sense of providing for their physical needs, but of putting before them an example of godliness. And that is just so missing in the church, and it's what I try to hit home to the fathers in my congregation all the time.
God bless you, Sean. You know, a dad shows a boy how to play like a man, how to laugh like a man, how to think like a man, how to stand up like a man, how to lead like a man. You know, it's so interesting if you just see something like this. I was watching something the other day. I saw a picture of a father wolf, and he had his mouth open, and he was howling. And beside him was this little tiny pup wolf with his mouth open, trying to be just like daddy. Now, if a wolf is like that, just imagine a human boy made in the image of God, trying to figure out what he's supposed to grow up and be like. You know, let's just pray that there's a daddy right there to show him what that looks like. What a high calling that is. Don't I know it? I've got a son myself. Thanks for your call, Sean. Let's go to Cameron, calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Go ahead, Cameron.
How you doing, Mr. Albert Muller?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you there in Dubuque.
Yeah, see, I think I have to go along with Paul on this one, and I think it's where he says, when I was a child, I did childish things. But
yeah,
when I became a man, I put away childish things, and I did things like a man. So I think when you can clearly see that, you know, a person is not doing childish things, then he's winning the manhood.
Okay, Cameron, I'm with you. When do you think that should come? Let me ask you for a chronology here. When would you be worried if you didn't see that in a guy?
Well, I don't know. I'm just going by looking at his actions and the decisions
yeah.
he makes and.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think that's exactly what the Apostle Paul's talking about. Of course, he's talking about spiritual maturity there, and he's talking about the maturity to put away childish things, and it is a great model. When I was a boy, a child, I acted like a child. I thought as a child. I spoke as a child, but no longer. A man has to put away those childish things. Now boys never, they never grow up to not have fun. That's another thing we as dads need to show our boys, and that is how a man has fun. I mean, a man has to be serious, but a man also has joy in his life. The joy of fulfilling his responsibility, the joy of his wife and his children, the joy of his calling, and the joy of his leadership. And yeah, the joy sometimes of just having fun in a God-pleasing way. You know, that's something that's really important. Just think about what it was like if you are a man, what it was like to be a boy. And you know that you look back at that as some real golden time. But most of us wouldn't want to go back there. I mean, we're glad we grew up to be a man. I am thankful that someone showed me how to get there. Who's going to show your sons, if not you? That's what we'll talk about when we come back with some final thoughts. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, you know, I find this a fascinating question because I work with an awful lot of young men. And I want to say, they are, by and large, an incredible group. You know, at our college and seminary, I get to see all these young guys who are going to be the leaders of the future. And by and large, the fact that they are here indicates They're the winners in this. They're the guys who understood manhood and are aiming for it. But I get some fascinating questions here almost every week, some question. And I get it in the local church, too. And I was in a local church not too long ago where there were a lot of homeschoolers, and I'm very, very supportive, as you know, the homeschool movement. But I had the question, you know, when should a teenage boy be taught primarily by men rather than by women? One of the challenges for homeschoolers is to figure out how to educate, especially older boys, in a way that honors their growing manhood, and understands the fact that a man needs to take the lead. A man needs to be there to provide that instruction. If not the actual every hour of instruction, then at least the overall direct supervision of the entire process, and the direct supervision of the boy's character formation and growth into maturity. I get other questions in the local church. What about teachers in the youth ministry, in the youth program? How old should boys be being taught by men and women, understanding the biblical pattern of complementarity? You know, these questions only matter to people who want to really be faithful to Scripture. If you don't care about it, you're not going to worry about it. And if you're not going to worry about it, well, you're probably not concerned about when boys become men either. But it is a big question. It's a responsible question for Christians to ask. And it's another wake-up call that we as parents and as Christian leaders, but let me say, first of all, as parents, we have to say this is our responsibility. And, of course, there's an analogous responsibility on the part of young women, but I just want to tell you, I think they're doing better than the young men. I think that girls are growing up to be women in a more natural way than boys are growing up to be men. I think the role models are broken. I think that boys are left to parent themselves. I think there's a lack of discipline. Yes, a lack of discipline. There's a lack of teaching. I think parents are sometimes just backing off of their boys way too early. And I think there are just a lot of lazy men out there who aren't showing up to do the hard work of showing their boys what it is to be a man. And putting some teeth to the definition. That's why I've offered my definition. On Thursday and Friday of this week, I'm going to have up a commentary at the site albertmuller.com that will really deal with this and put it out in writing. That way you can look at it and you see if you agree with it. Maybe you want to add something to my list of criteria here. But let's think about it. And let's put our best Christian thinking to the workplace here of our own space of living, our own family, our own church, our own congregation, our own place of service. Because if we're not thinking about this, no one's going to think about it. You know, the Jewish tradition does have the bar mitzvah. We don't have anything quite like it. But there needs to be some way that a boy knows what it is to become a man and has some assurance from his peers, the men of the church, the men of his family, that he's getting there. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation about the things that matter. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mohler's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.